It happened a few years ago in a music store. A friend of mine was shopping for an electric guitar, and the salesperson opened a box and pulled a plastic bag off a shiny black guitar with a single cutaway. And with some sense of reverence, he said, "This is a genuine Les Paul copy." Copy? That's the word that keeps the incident in my mind. A genuine copy? What's genuine? What's a copy? What's a fake? This is the realm Lydia Pine explores in her book, Genuine Fakes, subtitled How Phony Things Teach Us About Real Stuff. Lydia Pine is a writer and historian focused on the history of science and material culture. She is visiting researcher at the Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Texas, Austin. Lydia's writing has appeared in The Atlantic, The Scientist, and other publications. Lydia Pine, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you. You start with a really interesting premise that nobody likes to be fooled by a fake, but we love the stories of people who are. Is that simple schadenfreude, or is there something deeper there?
I think that that's a good question, but I think that there's a little bit of that schadenfreude of, oh, I want to hear how this person was taken for a ride, but sort of the assurance that I wouldn't have fallen for something like that. Uh-huh. So I think there's a little bit of that.
Interesting. So it's a level of like, haha, you're the dummy, I'm not.
Yeah, exactly. I think that there are some truisms of the human condition there that kind of shine through.
Well, so is this sort of like our confidence in our driving? We always think we can't be fooled?
Isn't that the sort of everyone thinks they're above average as a driver? And so there's this sort of assumption that I would never have been fooled by this kind of fake, or I would have seen through this trick, or I would have seen that or something like that. And so I think that there really is this sense that it's easy to judge those that are taken in or what have you.
So the mind goes straight to fake art and antiquities and me wondering how much broader is the field of fakes. I mean, is there a lot of stuff out there that's been faked over the years?
There is, actually. And one of the things that was really fun for me to unpack and discover in writing and researching this book was just how old the tradition of copies, fakes, replicas is. I think it's easy to think of it as a very sort of modern phenomenon, or at least sort of historical phenomenon, but there are lots of examples of collectors in ancient Greece and Rome being worried about being, you know, buying the wrong thing or being sort of sold this fake thing. And certainly reaching back even thousands of years before ancient Greece and Rome, there are examples of people trying to replicate things that they see in the natural world. And so there really is this sense of sort of mimicry or copying that's not necessarily faking the way we think about sort of a fraud having that element of deceit in it, but there really is the sense of sort of being able to build things that we see in the natural world.
Well, yeah, the idea of replicas is a really fascinating side channel here. I remember seeing the blue whale at the Natural History Museum in New York as a kid, and fascinating. But of course, I'm never going to see it in the natural world.
No, exactly. And sort of this idea that a model and a replica can sort of bridge this things that you can see and things that you can't see. But sort of having requirements for being able to convey scientific information or being an authentic replica, an authentic copy, and sort of being able to negotiate that kind of space between it. And it's interesting too, I think, to see sort of how that space changes over time, how we think about what counts as a good copy or what counts as an accurate copy. These are things that are negligible and that do change over time.
So what is a genuine fake, and is that your term or an accepted one?
So it is my term, at least as far as I've been able to unpack here in doing the research for this project. And it's a term that I sort of came to use to describe objects that I think that live in between the extreme ends of what we think of as real and as fake. And that I think it's really easy to see that objects sort themselves into real and fake. And so, I mean, some of the examples that you gave in your intro that we see, you know, Gucci bags where Gucci is spelled with one C or something like that. And it's really easy to sort of say, oh, I can determine that this is a fake, or, oh, this is the real thing. And I was really interested in the space that was in between those two extreme ends. And it was really interesting to me to explore these objects and to find that most objects and a lot of objects spend a lot of time in this sort of in-between state.
Well, and here's a real gray zone that you bring up early in the book. Andy Warhol works that were created after Andy Warhol died. Where did those come from?
Right. So I love the story of these Andy Warhols that are maybe not painted exactly by Andy Warhol himself. So the project, this art project, is called After Warhol, and it's done by an artist called Paul Stevenson. And in 2010, Stevenson bought several original Warhol acetates from the mid-20th century. They were the negatives that Warhol had used in his silk screening projects. And they still had paint. They still had paint that Warhol had used, and they were this amazing sort of historical artifact. And Stevenson does this really interesting thing where he sort of puts the question to audiences of, if I use the same materials, these same acetates that Warhol has done, and I've done this project in conjunction with experts that are very versed in Warhol's methods. And, you know, Warhol himself actually used a lot of assistance and a lot of help in creating these silk screens. Could we sort of make new Warhols? Could they be in keeping with the spirit of Warhol's as Warhol imagined his art? And Stevenson is very careful to not, you know, claim that these are original Warhols, but he sort of puts the question out there to audiences of, could they be authentic Warhols? And I think that sort of hair splitting becomes a really interesting way to push this question of authenticity and realness. And I think the jury is sort of out on what to make of Stevenson's project here.
Well, it's interesting though. Before we get to the break, there was an authentication board at the Andy Warhol Foundation, and what did that board do?
The board said that it was very difficult to put the effort into authenticating new works of Warhol, so non-Stevenson projects, but new works, and they would let Warhol's catalog stand as it is.
Oh, okay, so they're not going to bother to authenticate anything else.
Exactly.
I mean, in addition to replicas and ways in which we can portray things that might not be easily seen, I mean, the fact is that when it comes to things like artworks, there's good money to be made in fakes, isn't there, Lydia?
There certainly is, and I think that sort of offers a lot of the impetus for people wanting to create fakes, to create these forgeries. And so there's certainly this like push for the financial gains that go along with that. And one of the things that I think is really interesting about the sort of life history of fakes is the question of what happens to the fakes after they've been debunked. And that was the question that I really wanted to push in the chapters in Genuine Fakes that deal with art fakes and art forgeries, was the idea that, okay, this is a fake, it's been debunked, we know it's a fake, but then what happens to it? And it was fascinating to see that a lot of the time there are instances where these fake pieces of art become collectible in and of themselves, that they sort of begin to move along this continuum of authenticity and become a genuine fake to embrace this moment that it's able to be sort of both at the same time. And I found that transition to be really interesting, that something that starts out as this hokey fake or this forgery could, given enough time and enough cultural space, could actually transform itself back into something real.
Well, and that's the real fun of the story of the Spanish forger, for example, that people now actually go out and collect the works of this person, whose name we don't know. They're only known as the Spanish forger, S and F both capitalized.
No, exactly. And I'm so excited that you brought up the story of the Spanish forger. It really was one of my favorites to dive into when I was doing the research for this project. And as you say, the Spanish forger, we don't know who this forger was. We don't know whether it was a man, whether it was a woman. We don't know a nationality. We don't know anything except that this artist created these amazing sort of faux medieval panels and faux medieval paintings at the turn of the 20th century and created this really successful business of creating these fakes. And it's not until several decades later that they're discovered to be fakes, that they're not real medieval paintings. But at that point in the 1930s, they're sort of termed to be the Spanish forger's art. And then given enough sort of space again, enough decades past since the Spanish forger is known, there's a sense that they're collectible in and of themselves, and they sell well. I mean, they're very valuable paintings, and I like this sort of transition moment of you know, it goes from something that's, oh, this is just a Spanish forger and this is this fake medieval painting, to, wow, this is this collectible thing because it has this amazing story that goes with it.
Well, and you mentioned, I looked at the pictures in the book before I read anything in it, but the, some of the tells in the Spanish forger's work, the outturned feet and the lollipop-like trees, these are tells, but were they, is anybody thinking they might be actual Easter eggs that the Spanish forger was putting there to go, ha ha?
I don't know. I haven't come across that theory, but I like it. I like it. I really like the idea that the Spanish forger is sort of hiding little tells in and of themselves. But yeah, no, they're really fantastic. And once you know what to look for, I mean, it's sort of like a magic trick. Once you know what to look for, it's very clear. You sort of think, oh, how could you be fooled by this? But again, it's this sort of easy way that fakes and forgeries can sort of ingratiate themselves into their audiences.
Now, if you don't know nationality, why is this person called the Spanish forger?
So, sure. So the Spanish forger was called the Spanish forger because the librarian and art expert who was authenticating a particular Spanish forger painting, it was called The Betrothal of St. Ursula, and it was purported to have been painted by a very famous Spanish painter, a medieval Spanish painter. And so when the librarian, Bella da Costa Green, determines that this is actually a fake painting, that it's not a medieval painting, she nicknames the artist the Spanish forger. But yeah, that's pretty much all that the art world has been able to piece together about the story of this particular artist. It really is this sort of fantastic, unknown, unsolved mystery.
And on that level, it's very fun. Lydia Pine is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Genuine Fakes, How Phony Things Teach Us About Real Stuff. So let's move on from pictures to words and talk about William Henry Ireland and what he did for money.
William Henry Ireland is a great story. So William Henry Ireland, at the end of the 18th century, begins to create these phony Shakespearean plays, signatures, sort of all of these amazing Shakespearean forgeries. William Henry Ireland does this sort of in this gesture to try and get his father's attention, that his father was sort of this middling collector of rare books and manuscripts and Shakespearean stuff. And William Henry Ireland is convinced that his father will come to respect him if he's able to come across the Shakespearean signature or something to be able to contribute to his father's collection. So he does this, but only he does it by faking it, by creating this forgery. And his father buys it hook, line, and sinker and is just so over the moon that William Henry Ireland begins faking and forging more Shakespearean stuff. I mean, everything from family Bibles to he actually creates a new play that by all accounts is really atrocious.
And gets, you know, staged, though.
Exactly. And it's just sort of over the top. And he sort of has a good run for about 18 months before literary scholars debunk it and point out that there's no way that any of the Shakespearean stuff is actually by Shakespeare. And William Henry Ireland kind of slinks off to the pages of history here. And that's that. Except that he runs into financial difficulty in sort of his later years and begins forging his original fakes as a way to sort of sell them and to make money, to say, oh, everyone remembers these fake Shakespearean stuff here. I'm selling off, you know, some of these original ones that I had made.
Wait. So he was making forged forgeries?
Yes, exactly. That this sort of iterativeness of this is just, it's almost beyond belief. And that's one of the things that I really love about this story of William Henry Ireland is that the fakes just compound themselves and the fakes and the forgeries just build and it sort of, they take on this life of their own.
They do indeed. Okay, so let's move on from works of art then to fossils, or what were called fossils in the 18th century Bavaria, the lying stones. I mean, people did call a lot of things fossils back then, for one thing.
They did. And so that question of sort of what is a fossil is sort of the reason that this hoax and these fake fossils are able to catch on. So in 1725, Johann Beringer is a naturalist. He's working at the University of Würzburg, and by all accounts is a truly insufferable individual. And his colleagues decide that they're going to bring him down a peg or two and sort of play a prank on him. And so they have a bunch of these fossils, these quote-unquote fossils, carved. in limestone. And they're everything from sort of suns with rays that shoot out of them to worms that have little googly eyes and smiles. And they're really impossibly hokey looking sorts of fossils. But Barringer buys them hook, line, and sinker, and he's very excited. And eventually, it sort of comes out that he's been had, that he's been tricked, and that he turns around and promptly sues his colleagues for besmirching his good name. And his colleagues also sort of slink off here. And Barringer spends the rest of his career trying to sort of eradicate history, knowing that he had fallen for this great hoax. And so he's, you know, destroying stuff. He's trying to buy back copies of the book that he's written, all of these sorts of ways. And I became really interested in the story of Barringer's Lying Stones with, again, this sort of question of what happens to these fossils, these quote-unquote fossils, after they've been debunked, after Barringer knows that they're no longer, you know, going to tell us anything about evolution or natural history or anything like that. And it was fascinating to find them as real artifacts in museums. And so they had sort of, again, transitioned from being these fake fossils. They had transitioned into real artifacts, to the point where you can see them in, you know, museums in Oxford and in the Netherlands and other places.
Interesting. So they don't represent what he thought they represented, but they do represent him being taken.
Exactly. That they're not going to tell us anything about the natural world the way fossils today would, but they can tell us a lot about this episode from 1725. They can tell us about sort of the social networks of knowledge being made at the university and all of these sorts of things. And again, it's this transition that just because something starts out as fake doesn't mean that it has to be fake for its entire life history.
The book is called Genuine Fakes, How Phony Things Teach Us About Real Stuff. Author Lydia Pine is with us here on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join the conversation. Tell us if maybe you bought Tom Seaver's autograph and found that it was actually Tommy Scaramucci from down the street. Join the conversation by phone at 800-838-3760 or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Let's stick with the natural history category here because I love the story of the fly in amber at the Natural History Museum in London.
Decades. Yes. So there's this. So at the Natural History Museum in London, as you point out, there's this specimen. It's a fly. It's an amber, and you know, it's by all accounts this amazing sort of wonder of the natural world, and it's great. Until it gets put under a very hot light and microscope by a graduate student, and he sort of watches this. This amber open up and the glue melt out, and he's horrified, of course, but then realizes that what he's come across is this amazing fake that had somehow sort of made its way into the natural history collections. And I love the idea that these fakes can pop up anywhere and everywhere.
And then there's also a Piltdown Man. And it's interesting about sociological forces involved here, too. So why, for example, did the Brits trumpet that discovery so far and wide?
Right. So Piltdown was discovered, sort of quote-unquote discovered, in 1912. And it was this amazing fossil, sort of, again, quote-unquote fossil, that had a bit of cranium, a bit of skull, a couple of teeth, a little bit of jawbone. And for naturalists and paleoanthropologists in the turn of the 20th century, this was this amazing sort of missing link specimen that really sort of, to scientists in Britain in 1912, really sort of pushed this idea that this was the earliest Englishman and that this had really sort of, this was this really amazing sort of gesture toward European culture and all of that. It really was the sort of marker of who got there first. And so this is sort of how the Piltdown hoax becomes such a force, and so believable for those in Britain. There are some detractors who take a look at the Piltdown materials and say, you know, this doesn't quite add up. It doesn't look quite right, blah, blah, blah. But it is actually the longest running perpetrated hoax in the entire history of science, that it's not until 1954 that the Piltdown remains are discovered to be very, very modern, that they're not old enough to be fossils, that they're not, they're not even entirely, all of the bits of bone aren't human. There are some orangutan bits. There's a couple of chimpanzee teeth, all of these sorts of things. And it's not until the 1950s that the hoax is debunked.
Well, and now it's, there's an interesting realm here too, where you get into not just stuff scattered in sites like that, but where there's some real and some not real, like the Frankenfossils, as you call them. How are they created?
Right, and so there's this real sense, I think, that people see what they want to see, and that forgers and these fakes that are created are really speaking to what people want. So the Frankenfossils that you're talking to are fossils that come to the collector's market or what have you, that are sort of cobbled together to made out of real bits of fossils. So they're actually, you know, little bits of real fossil, but they're sort of cobbled together and shaped to be a animal, a specimen that collectors would want to buy. And so they really are sort of crafted toward giving people what they want and what they expect. And I think that sort of ties back to the sociological question that you put forward with the Piltdown remains, that there is a sense of giving people what they want, and that can be such a powerful force in why a hoax or a fake or a forgery can have such a good run of things.
Interesting. So you know, it's like, hey, people want to see fossils. These are fossils. They're not fossils quite the way they expected to get them, but they're fossils nonetheless.
Exactly. And that's certainly true, I think, for specimens that are going to private sales or that are sort of outside of a museum context, that there really is, I want a big, fancy trophy sort of fossil. Well, here's a big, fancy trophy, impressive looking fossil. You know, how real it is, this is coming sort of an open debate.
Lydia Pine, again, our guest, her book, Genuine Fakes. Let's move on to diamonds and fakes. So first of all, 1770s, Antoine Lavoisier, why and how was he setting fire to diamonds?
It's such an impossible sort of opening for the story of diamonds. So in 1772, Antoine Lavoisier is a French chemist. He's working a lot on questions of chemistry. He's working on questions of oxygen, and he's looking at sort of how minerals interact, how elements interact, all of these sorts of things. And so Lavoisier wants to know what diamonds are made out of and how diamonds work as a material object. And so he sets fire to them to see what elements distill out. And eventually, this series of experiments that he does, he sees that when diamonds are burned, there's a black substance that's left that was equal to the mass of a diamond. Lavoisier eventually names it carbon, and so when we talk about carbon, we're referring to these early experiments from Lavoisier. And the material makeup of the stuff that Lavoisier is left with is what we see in a diamond. And so before we can sort of get to this question of laboratory-grown diamonds or things like that we see in the 20th and into the 21st century, we have to sort of go back to the early stages of what makes a diamond in the natural world before we can understand how to make a diamond in the laboratory world.
It's huge pressure and heat and a whole lot of time, it sounds like, at least in the real world.
Exactly. So in the natural world, what makes a diamond, as you say, is heat, pressure, and time. And what's fascinating is that for a laboratory-grown diamond, there's this sense that we can short-circuit the time element. And so some of the earliest laboratory-grown diamonds in 1954 were actually created in something under half an hour. And so we've sort of bypassed this millions of years that it takes to make a diamond, that here in the laboratory, scientists can do this in a matter of hours or under hours. And so there's the sense that, you know, they're materially identical, that a natural diamond and a laboratory-grown diamond, they're both made up of carbon, and they both have a similar sort of arrangement of their atoms and things like that. But there's a sense of, is it a real diamond? Is it an authentic diamond? And certainly when laboratory-grown diamonds were first sort of put out by General Electric in the 1950s and sort of grew through the end of the 20th century, there's a sense from the diamond community that these are not real diamonds, that these are gems that you sort of make in the science lab and you can kind of wave your wand and the diamonds appear. But, you know, according to companies like De Beers or others in the diamond industry, a real diamond is something that's mined and something that comes from the earth. And that time that we were talking about, the time that it takes, that's an integral part of the identity of a diamond. And laboratory-grown diamonds sort of push back against that assumption, and they say, look, this is materially identical. Is it really necessary to have this temporal element to it?
So not being much of a diamond aficionado myself, are the laboratory diamonds generally just industrial uses, or are they out there as jewelry as well?
So they start out as industrial uses, and today there are lots of diamond companies that sell laboratory grown diamonds as the ethical alternative to naturally mined ones. Hmm. There are several that are definitely jewelry grade.
Lydia, I need to pause for a second. There's not some meta thing in here, is there? I mean, you are Lydia Pine, and you did write this book, right?
Well, yes, and I have to say that it felt like a very sort of existentially fraught project, that there were days where I just thought, wow, what is real anymore? And it was just really interesting that the more you sort of dove into these fakes and these genuine fakes, the less sure you became of anything sort of in the material world here.
I totally get that. Yeah, after reading the book, it's like, wait a second. Is this performance art on a grand scale or something?
Right.
All right, so when we get to the banana chapter, my head pretty much exploded. First of all, how many varieties of bananas are there in the world?
So the banana question is a great one. So right now there is one variety of banana that is out there and that is cultivated sort of on the mass scale. And what's fascinating to see the story of sort of banana flavor and how the flavor that we taste in bananas has changed over time. And this was something that was new to me, was looking at the fake banana flavor that you taste is actually an older variety of banana than what is cultivated and grown today. So the reason that it doesn't taste like a quote-unquote real banana is because it tastes like a historical banana.
So a different variety of banana.
Yeah, a different variety of banana that has since actually gone extinct. And so what you're tasting is actually this sort of flavor artifact.
So, but why does the banana industry go in on one type all at once? It sounds like every banana in the world now is identified as a banana, as a Cavendish banana, right?
It does. And that's part of that is just sort of how the biology of bananas and how bananas grow. Part of that is the sort of agricultural commitment to one crop, one variety of banana. And so what's fascinating is to think about, well, you know, in 10 years and 50 years, will we have sort of another artifact of a banana? Will we sort of have the Cavendish as this sort of banana that sort of is the 21st century banana flavor?
Well, so, but couldn't modern chemistry come close to the flavor of current bananas with the artificial banana flavor? Or is it just not a high priority? Do they just think that people are used to the fake banana flavor and we'll just keep the fake banana flavor?
So I love this question because I think that your sense of, well, why do we have this weird banana Laffy Taffy kind of flavor? It really gets at this heart of what do people expect and what is it that we're trying to mimic? So certainly it's possible to create Cavendish banana flavor in the world of synthetic flavor, but it wouldn't taste like the right kind of fake banana flavor. And so there really is this sense, I think, that the flavor industry is interested in sort of appealing to what we expect, and what we expect is that fake banana flavor.
That's
the
so
older banana. Yeah.
Yeah, that may be one of the best examples. It's like, no, we really appreciate the fake banana flavor because it tastes like real fake banana.
Exactly. And it's sort of if we were tasting something that tasted closer to what we would expect of the banana fruit, that would almost be unsettling. And so in that sense, again, it's this sort of like transition point where the fake becomes a real expectation.
Is this almost like the uncanny valley that scientists talk about when we're perceiving, for example, animation, like in
yeah.
Polar Express, for example, when it's like, it's creepy, it looks so much like Tom Hanks, but it's it's that close, but it's not Tom Hanks.
I really think that you're right, that there is this sort of, I don't know, uncanny valley of flavor, but yeah, I think that there's this, you can't change it because that's not going to be what you expect, or that's not going to be right somehow, that it really becomes sort of codified as one thing, and it's really hard to change that after the fact.
Indeed. Let's take a phone call here from Leonard in Eureka. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lydia Pine, the author of Genuine Fakes.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi. My question to Lydia is about provenance. And that my own experience is that provenance can be bought. It seems to be the only way sometimes to get it is to ship the painting to them, pay a large fee, and then you have your provenance.
All right. So,
would she comment on that, and would she comment on the integrity of that type of evaluation?
Okay, thanks for that, Leonard. Appreciate it. So, provenance or provenance is basically you're developing a custody chain back to the original painter, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the question is a really good one because it sort of builds the trust and it builds the sort of authentication process for a particular work of art. And so certainly when something is bought and sold with provenance, it sort of builds that sense that this is a real thing and that this is something that can be trusted. And certainly paintings that don't have good provenance, and certainly artifacts that don't have good provenance, it becomes very difficult to accept them as the real thing, that it really is that much harder. However, I'll also throw out there that provenance is like just about anything can be faked as well. And so there really is this sort of sense of how much do you as a buyer trust the provenance.
Interesting. So let me come back to flavors just a little bit longer because you get into there's a really interesting zone where it's like, what do we accept as? I mean, we accept that jelly beans are supposed to taste like fruit, for example, or licorice. But then when we got to this place where Jelly Belly was beginning to put out flavors like popcorn and bacon.
Right.
I mean, and isn't there vomit flavor too?
There is actually. There is a vomit flavor. There is a sweaty socks flavor. There are all of these things that are just sort of just almost beyond the pale that you just think, how can this be a real flavor? How can this be a natural flavor? How can this be a thing? And it's fascinating, I think, to sort of be able to trace that life history of that flavor and to see, okay, this is an example where, you know, the flavor scientists are putting a set of sweaty socks in a bag and sort of working to match the smell of this with the flavor taste of it so that there is this sort of authentic sweaty sock taste that comes out of these horrible jelly beans that are sort of put out as this joke line or this sort of novelty line from Jelly Belly.
Yeah, that's a whole interesting zone in itself because of the idea that they'd make something like that expecting people to buy it and actually put it in their mouths. And that I can't imagine, you know, above the age of 14, maybe you wouldn't consider it seriously, but who knows?
Well, they were very popular with my 12-year-old nephew, who is the person who introduced me to these horrible flavors. And so I think that it's targeted exactly at that demographic.
Ah, there we go. Let's move on to talk about nature films and photos. And this comes a little close to my experience as a longtime news photographer in the TV business was the fact that you can't stage things. But, you know, when you're not doing straight news, there's some wiggle room in there, and I was really amazed at the Disney company and what it did to Brown Lemmings in one film.
Yeah, the White Wilderness story, where we sort of, you know, in the 1950s, Walt Disney puts together this documentary called White Wilderness, and in it, there's this sort of famous scene now where we see lemmings going over the side of the cliff, and it's described as this mass suicide. And it quickly sort of enters like the cultural vernacular as this almost allegory for the dangers of groupthink or social conformity, except that we find that this is not lemming behavior. This is not what lemmings do. The scene is completely cut together by Disney. But it's become such a sort of pervasive myth that even today the Alaska Game and Fish Department has paragraphs sort of debunking this on their website. And so I think that what's interesting about this story, I mean, once you sort of get past the sort of horribleness of it, what's interesting is how the fake can really enter and really sort of burrow its way into popular culture.
Oh, because people assume that the fake thing is the real thing based on having seen it and have it repeated so many times.
Right. Well, there's a sense that, okay, this is a nature documentary. This is nonfiction. This is, this, you know, sort of carries with it this cachet that I trust it. I believe it. This is an authoritative source. And so sort of finding that line between artifice and art and sort of authenticity, I think is a really tricky triple point that nature documentaries have to balance out there.
You know, I haven't asked here so far, but you do use the term "the real thing" in capitals a lot. I mean, and how are you using the term?
Oh, that's such a hard question, but it's such a good one. I had wanted to sort of create this term. So we talked about sort of the term genuine fakes and how I use the term genuine fakes to talk about this category of objects. And I had wanted to come up with a term that sort of spoke to the idea of what we expect to be real. And I felt like calling something the real thing and putting it in capital letters was a way to sort of have people feel like, oh, I know what the real thing is based on my experience or based on my knowledge or based on, you know, sort of how I think about that. And so it the real thing, as I use it in the book, it is a little bit nebulous and it is a little bit broad, but I wanted something that people would be excited to sort of buy into and to be able to see as what they understand reality and authenticity to be.
I mentioned a little earlier about looking at the pictures in the book before I started reading it, and imagine my surprise when I saw somebody doing paintings like are on the caves in France.
But
it was a photograph of somebody doing those paintings. What's going on there?
Right. So the cave paintings that you're talking about are from Caverne de Pontarc, which is a replica of a very famous Paleolithic cave in France. The Paleolithic cave is Chauvet Cave, and it was discovered in the 1990s, and it has never been open to tourists. It's never been open to visitors because the paintings on the walls are so delicate, and visitors visiting destroy the paintings. And so France has opted to build a replica of Chauvet Cave, and the replica offers the opportunity for education, it offers the opportunity for outreach, for tourists to be able to see what the Paleolithic cave art looks like, and to sort of be able to intersect this being able to see something that you can't actually go see because of conservation or preservation demands. And one of the things that I really like about the story of the Chauvet Cave is, so Chauvet, the original cave, is protected under UNESCO World Heritage. And the UNESCO World Heritage designation for Chauvet actually has been extended to include the replica. And I really like the idea that an original piece of cultural heritage and Paleolithic art could have this sort of definition of it expanded to include its replica, that it's sort of the 21st century part of the cave.
Oh, wow. That is interesting that they're both included then, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And that really sort of challenges the idea, I think, and the skepticism of, oh, this is just a replica. It's just a copy. It's not the real thing. But it sort of makes us, I think, go back to your question about what is the real thing. And it sort of pushes us to say, well, could we expand the real thing? Could we extend our definition of it? Could we include the replica now as sort of part of how we think about the original?
Well, why don't we finish up in our last minute here with talking about Banksy and Banksy's piece that showed up in a British museum.
Right. So Peckham Rock, I think that's the piece that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. That shows up in Peckham Rock. It was one of Banksy's sort of rogue installations in May of 2005. And it's this sort of piece of cement that has this sort of person-like figure in a shopping cart, and he puts it up in the British Museum with a little label, very convincing-looking label, and it stays there for a couple of days before it's discovered and taken down. And that's that, right? It's sort of like classic Banksy kind of installation. In 2018, however, British Museum puts together a new exhibition called I Object, and it's a collection of 100 subversive objects that are found in the British the British Museum. And as part of this, they decide to include this Peckham Rock by Banksy. And so they have to ask for it back. And now when you go to see it as part of this exhibition, it was fascinating to see the original fake label, and then next to it is a contemporary label that explains the joke, that explains the sort of piece and why it's subversive.
Wow,
and again, it's this moment where you can watch it become this sort of not real thing to, well, here it is, and it sort of has with it the legitimacy now of being on a quote-unquote proper exhibition.
One more example of genuine fakes, how funny things teach us about real stuff, the book by Lydia Pine. Lydia, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Take care.